TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Outside the big cities, even in the industrialized countries, are the precious remnants of 90,000 years of evolution. On her own, the Earth has produced the wonders of nature, lineages of species, most of them much older than we, the humans, are. The current frightening rate of extinction began only 500 years ago, and Stephanie Mills, the first speaker in this program, says it is today 50 times higher due to modern technology and economics. Stephanie Mills is the author of In Service of the Wild and editor of Turning Away from Technology. She spoke at the teach-in on technology and globalization at Hunter College in early 2001. Stephanie Mills.
Technology and globalization have, over the last half millennium, done for the planet's biodiversity what the asteroid that hit the Earth and ended the age of the dinosaurs did. The synergy of technology and globalization is ending the evolution of whole lineages of life. Today, according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature's Red List of Threatened Species, one in four mammal species and one in eight bird species face a high rate of extinction. In the last 500 years, human activity has forced 816 species to extinction or extinction in the wild. The rate of extinctions now is 50 times what it would be without benefit of modern economics and technology. 50 times is an aggregated number, but the reality consists of lives and traits and talents, the wonders of nature, and the basis of life. Today, like Thoreau, I wish to speak a word for nature, because nature's flourishing, which means our own, is under devastating assault. So I'm going to talk about some of those lives and traits and talents to flesh in some of the details of what's going on out there beyond the human community. Why do you suppose that Thoreau, that great American pencil maker and sage, tax resister and bean planter, declared that in wildness is the preservation of the world? Perhaps it's because evolution is wild. This 4.5 billion year old planet has been, for all but the tiniest fraction of its history, wild. Of its own self-will, Earth has brought forth wonders: bowerbirds, coral reefs, compass plants, jellyfish, white pines, snow fleas, lammergeier vultures, root fungi, monarch butterfly migrations, 290,000 species of beetles, rainforests, prairies, sperm whales, wallabies, strangler figs, sturgeon, purple lady slippers, and Homo sapiens. Natural barriers like oceans and mountain ranges promoted this wild variety of life forms, this natural diversity and cultural diversity, its fruit. The adaptations to place and circumstance and the vast web of relationships amongst all these creatures are astonishing, but mostly overlooked. Consider the yucca and the yucca moth. This is a story of seed for seeds. In some species of Chihuahuan yucca and yucca moths, the female moths have specialized mouth parts with which they collect pollen from the yucca flowers. They gather the pollen and stuff a pollen ball into the yucca flower's stigma, which leads to the ovary, which holds the future yucca seeds, and is also the place where the moth deposits her eggs. So a portion of the seeds will feed the larvae, the future yucca moths. Insect pollination, as deliberate as this, is quite unusual. The moths and the yucca depend on each other. When the moths are absent, the yuccas don't set seed and soon die out. And when the yuccas are absent, there are no yucca moth nurseries. Such vital partnerships are everywhere in the wild and generally overlooked when the CEOs and their hench people in lab coats try to streamline nature for profit. Although Thoreau probably never saw a Chihuahuan yucca, he was a keen observer of the forestry practices of his neighbors, the squirrels and jays, and understood their collaboration with oaks and pines. All the free, self-willed phenomena he saw during his sauntering around Concord must have declared to Thoreau that in wildness is the preservation of the world. Wildness tells us that we can never do just one thing, that everything is hitched to everything else. But the extinction crisis is rapidly uncoupling symbiotic relationships, thus fraying the matrix of life on Earth. As a species, human beings have more experience being wild, living as semi-nomadic subsistence peoples, embedded in healthy ecosystems, than in any other life way. For about 90,000 years, wild were us. Agriculture has been going on a mere 10,000 years. Reliance on fossil fuels, 150 years. And human life has only come under the influence of computer-based technology in the last 30 years. Perhaps Thoreau was saying that we should hearken to our own deepest experience. Subsistence is given by the whole web of life, but in the accelerating drive to subjugate nature to profit, the narrowest of human purposes, technologies that are blundering in the extreme and global in their effects are unleashed. In the manufacture of paper, plastics, and pesticides and refrigerants, the chemical industry has managed to pervade the tissues of most higher animals on the planet with persistent organic pollutants. Many of these chemicals mimic hormones, which means that they interfere with the reproductive and developmental processes of many vertebrates. In some places, alligators, cormorants, and gulls have hatched with deformed gonads. And hormone disruptors have induced subtle damaging changes in the behavior and intelligence of children born to mothers whose diet included fish with POPs concentrated in their flesh. Are learning disabled kids and impotent wildlife a reasonable price to pay for progress? Nobody knew or thought to ask whether propellants like Freon would eat ozone, but they do, and extra exposure to ultraviolet radiation is a consequence. Increased UV exposure seems to be among the reasons that frog populations around the world are crashing. Nobody even knows where trifluoromethyl sulfur pentafluoride, which is a greenhouse gas 18,000 times more potent than CO2, comes from, but it's in the atmosphere now doing its work. Meanwhile, the trade geniuses are arguing against the precautionary principle, the sensible idea that new chemistries, technologies, and other tamperings with evolution should be presumed hazardous until proven innocent. No wonder there are Luddites still among us. Economic activities like longwall coal mining, gold extraction by cyanide leaching, clear-cut forestry, petroleum exploration, drilling, and transport may do their damage locally, but in sum, they accelerate a planetary extinction crisis. Unbridled profiteering at the expense of the wild has been affecting ecosystem-scale damage for centuries. The world trade in furs did a job on the North American landscape by decimating its beavers, of which there were an estimated 60 million in 1492. With their appropriate scale, low-tech dam-building talents, beavers renewed the landscape. Their pond-making, water filtration, and meadow creation led to a rich patchwork of habitats. Tough luck for the beavers that in the 18th century, beaver hats were all the rage. In 1743, just two shipments of furs to France included over 150,000 beaver skins between them. The modern era, then, with its relatively crude technologies like rifles, steel leg hold traps, double-bitted axes, two-man saws, ox-drawn sleds, canoes, railroads, and steamers spurred the extinction crisis. Wildlife and wild habitats in the New World were already depleted and fragmented going into our era of mega-technology and globalization. Given the imminent consequences of global warming for nature and humanity, at this point, it seems fair to call anything that promotes increased consumption of fossil fuels heinous. Transoceanic and transcontinental trade and mass travel by conventional means, the delivery systems of globalization, all come under this heading. Notice the two opposing patterns: globalization leading to simplification and instability, not to mention ugliness and misery; evolution leading to diversity, dynamic equilibrium, life, and beauty. Structural alternatives like relocalization exist and can favor life's flourishing. They have always outlasted empires. Locales have always outlasted empires. And the collapse of empires is the rule, not the exception. The vision and power and will to resist corporate imperialism and its technological tyrannies and to implement diverse alternatives desperately need to be kindled. So our job at this teach-in is to give one another reason and courage to declare our moral concern. Megatechnology and globalization are obviously reducing the diversity, abundance, and stability of life on Earth. It's wrongdoing at a cosmic scale, and it's our job to hearten and empower activists and citizens, scientists and technologists, bureaucrats and leaders to relinquish technical and economic arrogance and to work for the preservation of the world and the wildness that engenders the flourishing of human and more than human life. Thank you.
That was Stephanie Mills, author of In Service of the Wild, and editor of Turning Away from Technology. The next speaker is Langdon Winner. He's the author of Autonomous Technology, a study of the idea of technology out of control in modern social thought. The Wall Street Journal called him the leading academic on the politics of technology. Modern technology, Langdon Winner says, is under constant pressure of improvement, and there are a host of well-known devices that measure such improvement.
Miles per hour, bits per second, bushels per hectare, hamburgers per minute, and so forth. Modern technology is driven by the aspiration of instrumental improvement in every conceivable setting whatsoever, everywhere, without limit. And with all the indices of performance getting better every day, you'd think that the condition of the world overall would be getting better as well. And that, by the way, was the idea that used to be called progress, which we don't hear much about anymore, because the evidence that overall improvement is not occurring is too striking to deny. So the preferred word these days is simply innovation. It's progress without the idea that the world is getting better. Now, there are a couple of flaws in this program, you see, that stand in the way of improvement. Fascinations with questions about how anything is done begin to undermine and eliminate care about the ends. Now, the ends of human activity become clear to us when we ask questions about why. Why are we engaged in a particular activity in the first place? But after a while, the willingness to stand back and ask questions about why simply vanishes. And we accept certain trajectories as given. And these days, by this we usually mean improvements, technical improvements that deeply presuppose profit. Now, another casualty of technological aspiration is an eagerness to forget everything one may have ever known about context. The broader, more complex, interconnected places in the world where instruments can be inserted. Thus, in education today, which, by the way, is becoming a global information industry, we see the victory of that exquisite instrument, the computer, over any understanding of context. So people ask questions like, is course content delivered more effectively with chat rooms or interactive web pages? And people don't ask questions like, what are the ends of education in the first place? In what settings and through which kinds of human interactions does education flourish? If you ask such questions these days at conferences and workshops on education, people say, who invited him? And that's why, after attending many such events, I finally went on to invent the automatic professor machine, which is a 20-minute streaming video on my webpage. The first of a series of techno satires that I will produce, because I feel that many of the assumptions that underlie global technological civilization are so absurd that they really can only be meaningfully addressed in comedy. Now, the saturation of our activities and institutions by instrumental concerns is increasingly evident in the language that people use to talk about what they are doing and indeed who they are. In education for the past 15 years, for example, the term interactive has been used to describe results. But the word has nothing to do with people paying attention to each other and interacting. No, if you thought that, you haven't been paying attention. The term interactive simply means that a computer is at the center of what's going on. I'm not kidding about that. That's all it means. That's a technical term. Anthropologists who now study high-tech communities like those in Silicon Valley report that terms formerly used to talk about technology and business are now being adopted as metaphors for personal and family identity, so that people in terms like networking and connectivity and multitasking and just-in-time scheduling to describe their identities and relationships. The quest for narrowly defined technical improvement has spread rapidly from one point to another since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Technology goes where it has never been. Everything and everyone is colonized, pressed into service. Now, the most promising domains for such colonizations are ones that have somehow been sheltered from intrusion in the past. Today, the genomes of all species are targeted. The most intimate layers of personal and family life are targeted. Education, as I've mentioned, is targeted. Personal identity and conditions of well-being are targeted. It's important to recognize an error in our ways of thinking about the matter that we have inherited from earlier decades. And I'm speaking about the reputation that technologies are obnoxious because they are rigid and inflexible. This is kind of the Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times image of technology, you know, the big wheels and gears and so forth. And this may have been true in periods in which technical aspirations were realized in iron and steel and concrete, as well as in the tightly organized structures of assembly lines, let's say, or machine bureaucracies. But today, technical rigidity has been replaced by instrumental aspirations realized through strategies of extreme instrumental flexibility. Improvements sought are best achieved by continuous transformation. One must not rest, even for a nanosecond. If you do not change what you are doing continuously, in the quest of improved outcome, then somebody else will come along and replace you. That's the promise. Now, in production, some of the descriptors for this approach are flexible production and lean production. One ought to be able to change the tools and programs of design, manufacturing, distribution in a matter of days, hours, minutes, or even seconds. From a technical standpoint, it's now clear that human relationships are fleeting, team-centered, and rapidly decomposable. That's what the global economy presupposes. Thus, during the past decade, the human virtue of loyalty to others, and indeed, I think, increasingly care for others, has become largely obsolete in the economy. One must be ready to uncouple and move on. And people are getting very good at this. Now, you might think that among those most eager to address this challenging new situation and ask why we're involved in this would be the humanists and social theorists and social scientists of our time. But that is not what's really fashionable among prominent intellectuals today. The fashions of social theory now tell us that the world is populated by what are called hybrids. You may remember that word from corn, changing the genetic structure of corn. Well, now we're all hybrids. We have a room full of hybrids. And what this means that the world is full of entities, including human entities, that are described as composites of artificial and natural parts. In one popular rendition of this theme, humans are best regarded now as cyborgs, cybernetic organisms in which one's biological constitution is modified and enhanced by a variety of science-based techniques. Thus, anyone's being is not by any means given or stable or worthy of respect, but highly flexible, subject to a wide range of interpretations, and indeed a wide variety of projects in technical modification. Now, the significance of thinking about humans and other earth-dwelling creatures in this way is that now all boundaries between nature and technology that might have served as reference points for protection against the maniacal quest for narrowly defined instrumental improvement, universally, that those boundaries have now been breached. And the idea that anything might be left alone because it has integrity in being is a thoroughly outmoded concept in some circles. To say, let it be, is cause for jeers and howls of postmodern laughter. And increasingly, I believe those who raise questions about justice, democracy, sustainability in the global order must confront such people. What lies ahead are multiple and sweeping projects of flexible recombination, ones that capitalists like because they're profitable, one that engineers like because they pose lots of solvable problems, and that social theorists enjoy because they involve entities that are new and fascinating, playfully contestable, and deliciously weird. I do think the fascination of the weird in our technological era has great attraction for a lot of people. So one must look at the kinds of questions which are increasingly just not asked. Which practices, human relationships, institutions, and ways of being do we wish to foster? What ends and purposes ought to orient our activity? Now, to ask those questions immediately these days makes one a critic of technology and our technology-centered social systems. And I want to conclude by asking you to take that task, that challenge, seriously. If someone said, I'm a music critic, which I used to be, you wouldn't say, oh, you're just anti-music. But if you step forth as a technology critic asking the kinds of questions about, you know, why and where are we going, people immediately ascribe to you motives most vile. And I think this is a testament to the almost religious obsession that people have about matters technological at present. It's almost not discussable, almost beyond debate. So I want to encourage you, all of you here today, to engage in critical inquiry, critical discussion, reasoned debate about technology and our global economy. Well, what kinds of people do we want to be? What relationships to the biosphere do we want to have? What kind of society do we want to build? To discuss these matters and their obvious connection to technologies is not negative. It's not anti-anything, but highly positive work, which I invite you to join.
That was Langdon Winner, author of Autonomous Technology and The Whale and the Reactor. He is the editor of Democracy in a Technological Society. Next week, you will hear from Jeremy Rifkin, author of Beyond Beef, The End of Work, and The Biotech Century. These speakers were recorded at the 2001 Teach-In on Technology and Globalization, organized by the International Forum on Globalization. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can get a copy of today's program that includes next week's talk by Jeremy Rifkin for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us continue our work. Our mailing address is TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. Our website is www.tucradio.org. You can order with your credit card by phone or on the web. Call us toll-free at 877-TUC-TAPE for more information on how to do this. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Glidden. Thank you for listening.